morning, ladies and gentlemen. We'll hear argument in the case of United States against Gomez. Pray.
May it please the court, counsel, the 404B evidence in Nicholas Gomez's case is pure propensity evidence and should have never been admitted by the district court. This harmful propensity evidence was admitted against Gomez because the current circuit 404B test is not effective in screening for propensity inferences. As such, this court should adopt a new test, a stronger test, as set forth in the court order granting rehearing en banc in Gomez's case. That test specifically asks whether the proposed evidence is relevant to any specifically and identifiable and disputed non-propensity issue. Two, and if so, how the evidence is relevant to such issue without relying on propensity inferences. And three, whether under Rule 403 the evidence would be unduly prejudicial.
Now, those are the magic words you want the district judge to say so it meets our requirements?
Well, I think that it's more than just magic words. The current test that's used in the circuit is a magic words test. What the judges do is they identify a proper purpose under 404B for the evidence, and that's where their analysis ends instead of begins. And that's what Miller wants us to do. We want the new test. That is just the first prong. One, identify the disputed issue. And the right test, the new test is the right test because you have to specifically identify the disputed issue.
But why does the issue have to be disputed? The government's burden is to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, so they don't have to just stop when there's no dispute, do they?
Miller requires a meaningful dispute. The recent court decision in Miller specifically states a defendant must meaningfully dispute the non-propensity issue justifying the admission of Rule 404B evidence. The current test also requires a meaningful dispute,
well,
because it says matter in issue.
So matters are an issue that the government has to prove, even if the defense hasn't affirmatively disputed or called into question a particular element, the government still has to prove it.
Well, my position
does
is...
Does this mean it has to be relevant?
Relevance doesn't go far enough, Judge.
So are you saying that for evidence that might fall into the propensity area, there's a higher test that Rule 404B somehow implicitly incorporates? Obviously, in general, relevant evidence is admissible, right?
So, correct. 401, 402, 403
right, sure.
are...
And if the government thinks that some prior acts evidence that is in the category of permitted uses should come in, unless there's a special rule, you wouldn't say it needs to be disputed. So I guess what I'm wondering is whether this is part of the extra precautions that you think need to be taken to avoid an impermissible use. I mean, in other words, adding this requirement of a disputed issue.
Beasley requires the principal exercise of discretion.
Well, so we're sitting in bank. You need to give us reasons at this point, because we're sitting in bank and we can modify if we think we need to earlier cases.
Well, what I want to say is that the current test, the principal exercise of discretion, is taking place at the appellate level. And what we want to do is we want to give the district courts a framework like the new test that forces the district court to do the hard work before admitting the evidence, identify the disputed issue.
I think you're missing the point of the questions, which is where does the requirement that an issue be disputed come from? It may be difficult to find that in Rule 404. Perhaps if you're pitching a disputed issue point, you should be relying on Rule 403. And that, of course, is subject largely for the district court and not the Court of Appeals.
Well, 404B specifically It says the word proves.
Look, counsel.
I'm sorry.
Rule 404B lists which purposes are permissible and which are not. From the subset of permissible purposes, Rule 403 may impose some additional requirements because evidence that might be used for propensity could be unduly prejudicial. So if you're searching for a limit beyond what the text of Rule 404 provides, don't you have to turn to Rule 403?
Well, 403 is incorporated in the new test. Prejudice analysis is the last prong of the test.
But it's only it's always available to a party.
Absolutely.
The evidence is unduly prejudicial. It's nothing special to this issue. Look, what do you you're talking about what the judge should do in deciding admissibility. What should the judge tell the jury if he decides to admit?
We think that a limiting instruction like the instruction in the Seventh Circuit jury instruction 3.11,
that's
evidence of other acts by defendants should
terrible,
be used.
That's a terrible instruction.
It's a step in the right direction.
What does that mean? What's the good to have a step in the right direction? Why not have a good instruction that's clear? Lay people are not going to understand.
It's a step in the right
direction. What is that? What's the step in the right direction? How about a good instruction? Can you think of a good instruction? Or you just want to take steps toward a good instruction?
I can think of a good instruction, but it would parrot the new test proposed in the court orders.
In other words, you don't have any, you don't have a suggestion for
The suggestion for a better instruction would be specifically identify the disputed issue for the jury and tell them how they can...
That's not an instruction. The instruction is what you tell the jury. Now, you don't have an instruction to suggest.
I have an instruction that would specifically identify the issue in dispute and would specifically tell the jury how they can use this evidence.
That's not an instruction.
And then I would caution them...
That's your... idea. That's your notion of how to design an instruction. But you don't have an instruction to suggest.
My instruction would say that this evidence is being offered to prove the specifically identifiable disputed issue and then place that in the instruction. And then after that, you can consider this evidence for that purpose. You cannot consider it for any other purpose. That's what my instruction would be.
Okay, then that's a lot simpler than 311.
Would it be helpful to tell the jury that the issue is not whether the defendant is a person of good or bad character as part of this instruction, but whether the government has proved this specific charge beyond a reasonable doubt?
I think that would be a valuable addition to the instruction. Yes, I do.
Suppose the defendant doesn't want an instruction. Suppose the defendant thinks, gee, to have an instruction will just highlight this evidence again and the jury has heard it. Would you have the background rule be no instruction unless the defendant asks for one, or would you have the background rule be you'll give an instruction unless the defendant specifically says that he doesn't want one?
Well, I think the federal rules incorporate that the defendant has to ask for the limiting instruction.
Okay, so you agree if the defendant doesn't want any of these limiting instructions, you would agree that they don't have to be given?
That's correct.
Okay.
The government.
You think
the
court has an obligation or should ask then when this testimony comes in, would you like a limiting instruction just to make sure the defense understands they have the right to get a limiting instruction?
Absolutely. I think the federal rules of evidence require that. And I'm actually in the camp as a trial lawyer for almost 25 years at this point, instruction should always be given.
Which rule requires this?
I believe it's 105.
But I thought 105 required a timely request. The court has to do it upon a timely request.
Which to me
Huddleston says that specifically incorporated 105, and 105 says that the antagonist gets the instruction if he requests it.
Is this at the time the evidence comes in or at the final instruction?
Well, the final instruction will be given in the Seventh Circuit, but it should be given, in my opinion, at the time that the evidence is admitted. If there, you know, all 404B evidence has propensity inferences, once the evidence comes in, the elephant is in the room. And I think that you should notify him then there what the purpose of this evidence is, why this elephant's in the room, and then limit their use immediately as to how...
That sounds so naive.
This goes to Judge Wood's comment about focusing on it. Maybe the counsel doesn't want it to be focused.
Well, that's why, as Judge Tinder said, Rule 105 says on timely request. And you've agreed that if the defendant stands there and says nothing, then the judge has no obligation to give the instruction.
That's correct. If the defendant objects, the federal rules of evidence say
right.
that. That's
he doesn't
correct.
Say anything.
But if he says nothing, no instruction.
If he doesn't say anything, no instruction. That's correct.
No, that so Rule 105 doesn't say that. It doesn't say an instruction is prohibited unless the defendant allows it. It just says if the defendant requests it, one must be given. So I'm still interested in what your answer might be to Judge Wood's question about the preset. Should our preset be that an instruction is given if the defendant is silent?
My preference is that the defendant should be given at the time of the admissibility of the evidence and also in the closing instructions to the jury. It should be a requirement. I can think of no legitimate reason as a trial lawyer to not give this instruction.
So you really believe in limiting instructions? You think they're
I think that they're the best source of effectiveness. You can never totally exclude propensity inferences, but once the elephant's in the room, you have to work to limit.
Once the elephant is in the room, you're now painting the elephant. You're making him more prominent. You're reminding the jury. You're telling them not to do what their common sense would tell them they should do.
If what we're looking for is to eliminate propensity inferences from the jury's decision-making and get good decisions by the jury, then the elephant's in the room. Explain why the elephant's in the room, and then...
a neurological procedure.
But aren't you saying, though, that even though it may be a third best option, once the evidence has come in, you'll settle for that as opposed to letting the jury run with the propensity thought?
We want the jury to know why the evidence is in evidence and what they can use it for.
If the new instruction, if we go with this direction of a much more specific instruction, it's very easy for me to imagine that the government might very well want that instruction given. They have the judge explain to the jury exactly why this evidence is relevant to show, for example, as in one of our cases, that this defendant who denied knowing the seller in this case actually had been convicted of a transaction with the very same seller 5 years earlier, okay? So, at least the way I read Rule 105, if the government asks for the limiting instruction, the judge must give it, if either side asks. So I think we need to get that possibility on the table as well.
My position is that the instruction should be given in all circumstances at the time of the admission of the evidence. I think that there is no legitimate purpose for a defense lawyer to not want that instruction.
Counsel, that assumes that all theories of admissibility are the same, and that kind of categorical rule is just inappropriate in the evidentiary context. There are different theories of admissibility, different purposes of admissibility, and having a categorical rule like that doesn't make any sense. It's really very case-specific.
Well, if you identify...
It's all within the domain of discretion in terms of the trial court tailoring instructions to the specifics of the case.
If you identify the specific issue in dispute, the instruction will also have the purpose of helping the district court to evaluate the evidence. The issue
that
in dispute.
That happens pretrial. That happens pretrial outside the
it's not
hearing
happening.
Of the jury. Or if during trial, outside the hearing of the jury. We're talking about what the jury should be told and when. And that's really very case-specific, and there may be different strategic reasons for the government and for the defense to prefer or not prefer an instruction, why would we adopt a categorical rule that excludes the kind of tailoring that seems to be necessary in this context?
My position is that the elephant is in the room. Explain why the elephant's in the room, and then work to limit it. That's what defense attorneys do.
Well, let me ask. No, finish your answer. I'm sorry.
The government wants the instruction because it makes the record clear as to why the evidence is being offered. It identifies the specific issue in dispute.
Right, but it really depends on the size of the elephant, right? I mean, if it's like a really little elephant, then
maybe
the instruction, if it's a really big one, and giving the instruction paints it, as Judge Posner said, then, you know, maybe it's a good idea to give it or not. I mean, it really depends on the case.
It does depend on the case, and only by way of one thing. We used to fight over whether the defendant would ask for, the defendant has an absolute not right not to testify instruction. We used to argue about that in district courts. Should we bring this up? And you know what? After 25 years, tell them that that's what the law is and let them use the law. They're supposed to follow the law. They're told repeatedly to follow the law. Let's give them the law. And let's hope and pray that they follow the law. But to say that by not telling them that it better serves the function of the jury and letting them speculate as to why this evidence was, it serves absolutely no purpose. And that's
and that's your point when you say you can't think of any legitimate reason not to give it, because otherwise the testimony comes in like any other testimony and the jury can use it for whatever purpose they want. So they may draw the inference he committed this act before, therefore it's most likely that he did it this time. Is that
That's
your
correct.
Point? That's why you're saying you can't think of a legitimate alternative.
Mr. Pietro, what if you wanted a defense where you thought the government had a grudge against the defendant and they caught him on prior occasions, so they just assumed he did this? Wouldn't that be one where you wouldn't want it, a limiting instruction? Say, okay, sure, he was convicted before. He's not on trial for that.
I would like to analyze the prior case using the new instruction, Judge. And I would like, the instruction is the second part of the test. The first test is let's screen out this pure propensity inference.
Well, so,
that's
and
why
I
I'm here today, to screen out this pure propensity inference.
So
and
it
we
seems
need
to
a
me
new
we've,
instruction.
We've detoured a lot into the instruction without figuring out what comes in. And actually, the first question we had asked for consideration in this in-bank rehearing is what needs to be established. And so we've already discussed whether the issue needs simply to be relevant, thinking of cases like Old Chief, or whether it has to be disputed. There are other aspects as well to this, like should we mention, as we have done before, that the evidence is sufficient to support a jury finding? Is that a useful part or not? Is there any point in cross-referencing other rules? Obviously, evidence has to be relevant under 401. Obviously, 403 is available. Is there any virtue in folding, in some repetitive sense, these other evidence rules into the 404B analysis that we want judges to go through? And finally, in what detail in this sidebar, I'm assuming for the moment outside the presence of the jury, in what detail does the proponent of the evidence, usually the government, have to spell out the chain of inferences? What do you envision happening there?
I think if the new test forces the district court to spell out the chain of inferences, that will force the proponent to seriously look at the evidence and spell out the chain of inferences for the district court.
And how does that chain, just to become a little more specific, play out on the identity issue for Mr. Gomez in this case? How would you apply your rule to Mr. Gomez's case?
Mr. Gomez, we have 404B evidence. 26 days later, a packet of cocaine allegedly in Gomez's
14 grams, as I recall, half an ounce.
In allegedly in Gomez's bedroom. The court allows it in for knowledge, identity, and absence of mistake. Knowledge was never an issue. So you put knowledge in issue, and now you have a limiting instruction and a jury instruction that is meaningless to the jury because knowledge is in there. Absence of mistake was not an issue. So now we have another meaningless phrase in the instructions for the limiting instruction.
But Judge Wood isn't asking you about the instruction. She's asking you what the test for admissibility is.
Right. So when that evidence was proffered, what would you have liked to have seen the district court judge say in his analysis? How would you envision that conference or that discussion between yourself and the prosecutor and the district court judge among the three of you?
The government has offered this cocaine to prove whose voice Guerrero is on these phone calls, to prove the identity of that voice. If he did any analysis whatsoever, this packet of cocaine, unless it had a voice print on it somehow, does not prove that Gomez participated in this conspiracy.
Well, it does, but by way of
and it would have been excluded.
Right.
I'm sorry?
It does prove it, but by way of the propensity.
Only by the propensity
step. By propensity inferences.
Yeah.
A proper analysis would have screened the evidence out of existence in Gomez's case.
Was there any sort of CSI type of study of that 14 grams? In other words, was it the same purity as the drug seized from Romero's car? Did it have similar diluents as that? Is it packaged the same way? Is there any comparison?
It's my position that it wasn't cocaine, and I brought that up to the district court that it wasn't cocaine. The chemist testified and had to redo his tests for the purposes of trial, and then we actually analyzed it. It was 13% pure, according to the chemist.
How did that compare with the drug seized from Romero's car?
The drug seized from Romero's car were substantially more pure, Judge.
So if it came from that, it was cut substantially.
Correct. I don't think it was cocaine.
No unique diluent in the September 29th, 14 grams that was also present in the seized drugs?
No.
Okay.
So you're in your rebuttal time, but I'm just going to put a marker down that when you get back up, I will at least be interested in your discussion of the government's harmless error point.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Petro.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Fullerton.
May it please the court. Other Act evidence should be admissible at trial if it is relevant, if it does not rely on propensity or character inferences, and if its probative value is not outweighed by the risk of unfair prejudice. The admissibility of the evidence should not depend on whether the defendant actively disputes an issue to which the evidence goes.
So, Mr. Fullerton, I wanted to ask. Go ahead, Judge.
I see your point, in the briefs up to this point, about the connection between Mr. Gomez's residence and one of the phones used during this conspiracy. But what did his possession of a relatively small, really relatively small cocaine, if it was cocaine, in that residence add?
Judge, the evidence of the cocaine, 14 grams, there was testimony that it was typically a distribution amount of cocaine.
But you've given that up. I mean, this is called a user quantity throughout this case. I mean, the government kind of slipped that into its brief, supplemental briefing, but I think it's a little late in the day to start arguing about whether 14 grams is or isn't a distribution.
And indeed, Judge, the testimony was a little bit ambiguous because it was typically a distribution quantity. It could have been a user quantity.
Sure.
But.
And you have presented this case, and certainly the panel opinion took the assumption it was a user quantity.
Well, the point I want to make is that it's an element of the description of the man on the phone which Nicholas Gomez matched on September 29th.
Wow.
The man on the phone lived at a certain address. He had certain phones. He spoke Spanish. He had a certain voice.
And you could have said all of that without mentioning that he had cocaine in his room.
And, well, one of the things about the man on the phone who was guilty of the conspiracy charge was that he had cocaine. He had cocaine for resale. He had access to cocaine. He wanted to possess cocaine.
So virtually everybody on the south side or west side of Chicago who has a little bit of cocaine in his or her room fits this description.
No, of course.
Unfortunately, not. Given what we know, that's a lot of people.
That element is common to many people. But when in conjunction with the other elements of the description of the man on the phone, it was valuable in confirming the identity offered by the agents.
You agree with Mr. Petro that the cocaine seized on September 29th was not traced to the conspiracy cocaine?
That's correct. There was no unique...
It's just everyday cocaine, right?
As far as we know, there was no unique packaging, for example, that would identify it as being from the same shipment or from the same distributor or anything like that.
I think we're getting off the issue. I thought, you know, the purpose of the en banc was to discuss the standard and the instruction. Now, I think what you're saying, which actually I think is all that's involved, is that it's just a 403 issue, right?
That's right.
So it's either, it's got to be relevant, but since, but the unduly prejudicial element in Rule 403 is very important in these cases.
Yes.
It's much more likely to have undue prejudice when you have evidence about other criminal activity of the defendant. So is that it for the standard? Is there anything useful? Is there any reason to have anything special on top of 403 to deal with these issues?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
But you said in your brief, how is the elephant's relevant? Actually, the first part of your sentence is just a long-winded way of saying, is it relevant? But then you say, if so, how is the evidence relevant to the fact without relying on impermissible propensity inferences? We know from other federal rules of evidence that propensity is a form of relevance. That's true in the sex offense rules, but we have to delete that form of relevance. And so how could we rely only on 403 without taking care of what you yourselves argued for Part A of your test?
Well, as I understand it, Rule 404B is the one that does the work of eliminating the
right, but Judge Posner said, is there anything to 404B other than 403? And I'm saying you argued that the test should be whether the proposed evidence is relevant, and if so, how is it relevant without relying on propensity?
Right. I must have misunderstood the question, Your Honor. The evidence must be relevant, must not rely on propensity or character.
I don't understand that. I would think that if it relies on propensity evidence, then it's going to be unduly prejudicial.
Well,
Rule 404B says, Part 1, prohibited uses. So don't we need to give that some independent force?
The prohibited use is the one that draws the inference from the character of the defendant. The evidence shows the defendant has a certain bad character from his prior acts that the jury is then asked to infer that he must have committed the current act.
So you would need in the course of a trial to assure the district court judge that you were not planning on using the evidence for this impermissible purpose.
Yes. Yes.
Wholly apart from 403.
Yes. Okay. Yes. And that type of analysis is part of the current formulation that the court uses. We think it's obviously should remain in place. The part about what is in dispute, we think it's important that not be imported into the question of what is relevant, but rather be considered under the question of whether the probative value of the evidence is outweighed by the risk of unfair prejudice. We can imagine relevant evidence that is not going to the defendant's character, that is not disputed.
What 404B says is that you can't use the propensity evidence to prove. You can't use the other crimes evidence, other bad conduct evidence, to prove that someone has a character which caused him to commit the present crime. That's different from saying that if there's a propensity element in the evidence, if a jury might infer propensity from the evidence, has to be excluded. Right? I would think it would depend on whether it made the evidence unduly prejudicial. If you have evidence that's relevant, helpful, probative, and a little prejudicial, right, then it's admitted.
Well, as I understand the Rule 404B, it talks about character. The case law has talked about character and propensity almost interchangeably, so that the prohibited inference from character becomes very similar to the type of propensity inference that you're talking about.
The unreality of this is that people do have propensities, and the more crimes they commit,
well, that's certainly true.
You can exclude evidence just because a jury might take it as propensity evidence.
Well, the risk, Judge, I think, is that the jury might conclude from the defendant's history of crime that either he's got this character and he must have done this crime, whether or not he actually did,
that's what the rule says, in order to show that on a particular occasion the person acted in accordance with it. So Judge Posner is certainly right. I mean, there's propensity running through a huge amount of this evidence, but it all depends on the issue that you're trying to use the prior wrong or crime or whatever evidence for. And I think that takes us to the need to focus it, and actually takes me to Mr. Gomez's case, where, you know, just because he had cocaine on one occasion, does that mean he's the voice that was dealing cocaine on another occasion? I find very difficult to see how that's anything but propensity evidence. But the focus on, are we using it to say that because you did it before, you did it this time, or in this case, you did it later, you did it the earlier time? That's what we can't do.
Right, or he's such a bad guy that we don't care if he did it this time.
Well, that's true. That happens right. Too, I guess.
this reminds me of the stereotype. Propensity may be exchanged for stereotype.
Right. That's a
concern. There were other people in the house, so why is the fact that he had cocaine so significant in suggesting that he was on the phone?
It was an element of the description of the man on the phone that Nicholas Gomez matched on
September
29th.
How does it distinguish him from the other people in the house?
The other people in the house didn't have the phone that was intercepted on the wiretap.
There is the phone in the house was accessible to any of them.
It was
locked up somewhere.
The phone that was seized on September 29th was next to Nicholas Gomez's wallet.
It was in the kitchen, right?
I'm sorry?
It was in the kitchen, public space, or, well, relatively public space in the house.
That's correct.
Can I ask you a question, Mr.
Each other's phone, right? And also, you know, in your brief, your latest, I think it's your latest brief, supplemental brief, is that, or is it? Yeah. But you have your discussion of the harmless error issue, which of course relates to the prejudice or use of the evidence to prove propensity. It's quite perfunctory.
Can I ask you about the harmless error question, Mr. Fullerton? Obviously, the government had a lot of other evidence against Mr. Gomez, at least if he's identified as the voice on the phone. On September 3rd of 2010, agents stopped and frisked Gomez, right?
Yes.
They got his consent to frisk by lying about their purpose. They made up a story about investigating weapons. He consented. They found no weapons, drugs, or cash, right? That was after he had met with Romero.
It was after he had initially met with Romero, they met again a second time.
Okay. Do we know anything about whether whether Gomez and anybody else were related as brothers-in-law?
Nicholas Gomez, as I understand the record, was the brother-in-law of Victor Reyes.
And there was a phone call introduced into evidence from September 3rd in which Romero and Guerrero, whoever Guerrero was, were talking, and Guerrero says that the police stopped his brother-in-law earlier that day.
There was, yes, the police stopped.
So do we think it's more likely that Gomez was the guy on the phone or a raise or somebody else?
This is actually a good point, Judge. There was the agent stopped both Gomez and Reyes on September 3rd. There was conversation on the phone.
Okay.
There was conversation on the phone between Romero and Guerra, who mm-hmm. believes Gomez, which both stops were talked about. Now,
counsel, would you move back to the center and speak more into the microphone? We want to make sure this is adequately recorded and can be heard by everyone.
Thank you, Your Honor. Both stops were talked about on the telephone on September 3rd. Now, the agents had stopped Gomez on foot on the block near his apartment. They had stopped Reyes by pulling over his car, the car that he was driving on that day. And Guerra, in speaking with Romero on September 3rd, indicated that he, Guerra, had been stopped on foot.
Are these conversations in Spanish or in English?
They were in Spanish, Your Honor.
Okay. Do you have any information about how accurate voice identification is for a foreign language?
Such as statistical studies or anything like that?
I mean, we know that there's a bad record of visual identification across ethnic groups, and I just wondered how well, if people are sitting around identifying voices speaking in a different language from their own, that works.
I could see where it might be a problem, but one of the witnesses who identified Gomez's voice and testified at trial about it was the linguist who assisted in translating the recordings for use at trial and the transcripts. That's one thing. The other thing is that the jury had available to it the recording, the disc of all the Spanish language recordings, as well as the transcripts when it went back to deliberate on their verdict.
But so they weren't played at the trial, were they?
They were not played out loud at the trial because they were in Spanish. That's right. But had the jury had a question...
Wait. What could they do with the recordings in their jury room?
They could listen to it and...
But did you say... But it's in Spanish.
It's in Spanish,
what
but...
What does it do to listen to it?
Well...
Now, maybe you could say, well, you can compare voices, even if you don't know the language.
Right.
But then why wouldn't the recordings be played in the courtroom?
Well, that I'm not sure of. I imagine it'd be difficult.
It's a little suspicious, actually. You think if the question is this the same person on the phone, why not play it? Now, I can see an argument. Well, somehow it's being in Spanish would just confuse everything. You think it's confusing for people to be trying to figure, voice identification in foreign language. You shouldn't allow the jury to have it in the jury room. What? Right?
Well, Judge, I can...
There's no reason to let them have it in the jury room if you think that it shouldn't be in the trial because it'll mislead them.
I could see where the judge could conclude that it would be take too much time to play them.
Was there any Spanish-speaking people on the jury?
I'm not aware of that.
Was that offered? Did anybody offer to play it in the courtroom?
I'm not aware of that. The point I want to make about having them available in the jury room is that Gomez, when he was stopped by the police on September 3rd, gave a telephone number. He gave one telephone number. As during the course of the wiretap, Gomez was intercepted using three telephone numbers. Now, Gomez
is... A voice is intercepted with three telephone numbers, and
right.
You are asserting that it's the same voice.
Right, and what I'm suggesting is that the jury had available to it voices from each of the three phone numbers to compare to the one that Gomez admitted was his.
Look, it's extremely strange to present evidence in the jury room. That's extremely improper. Evidence is in the trial. Then you give them stuff to take with them into the jury. You don't give them new evidence.
No, Judge, the recordings were admitted in evidence. I'm just saying they were not played out loud at trial.
Yeah. So but that it would, means it would, that no, you know, lawyer couldn't comment about, well, you heard this, and this is the same, or this is different. Right?
It would be unusual to find harmless error on the assumption that the jury, none of whom we knew speak Spanish, listened to recordings that were never played and drew their own conclusions.
I know,
that's not your argument, is it?
I don't mean to make this the greatest part of my harmless error argument.
Okay.
That's a relief.
What do you favor in the way of an instruction? Do you like 311?
311 is good.
Is not good. Say that. That second sentence is going to shipwreck the jury. Before using this evidence, you must decide whether it's more likely than not the defendant did the crimes that are not charged in the indictment. That is a very confusing situation.
Instruction one from the Uniform Seventh Circuit Uniform Instruction.
I know, and I'm unhappy with it.
It was from the Uniform Instructions, wasn't it? Seventh Circuit Pattern Jury Instructions.
It's 311.
The fact that instruction was approved by the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals.
It was, yeah. Now,
And who was the chairman of that committee?
I think it's difficult. It is very difficult for counsel when multiple judges are speaking at once.
On the jury instruction issue, we think that instruction can be very helpful and ordinarily should be given, one that is more specific than the one that was given here, one that specifies the manner in which the evidence can be used, and I think one that I think is in 311 says that the defendant is not on trial for the other acts or other crimes or other wrongs.
That doesn't really shed light on the impermissible propensity inference, though, and this is where Judge Hamilton's improvement might step in. It doesn't really tell the jury what it can't consider the evidence for, which is the bad character inference.
No, I think
and
that
many other jurisdictions have instructions that do contain that sort of warning to the jury. The state of Wisconsin does. I'm familiar with that firsthand, and wouldn't that be an improvement on this instruction because it would specifically tell the jury what's an impermissible use of the evidence, but whatever that's worth in the dynamics in the jury room.
I think that would be an improvement, to spell out both what it's permitted for and what is not permitted for, character or on trial for some other crime or wrong or act. That would both be helpful. Now, I say it should...
The admissibility of evidence is the role of the trial judge, right? All
yes.
Prior bad acts, I think we can agree, carry with it the risk of propensity evidence. So is it the government's position that 403 should do the heavy lifting and we just want some analysis from a particular judge, district judge in a particular case that spells it out in greater detail than, for example, what we have in this case?
403 does a lot of the heavy lifting. 404B does some of the lifting as well. And it does the lifting when it's offered for character.
403 sets out a maybe impossible standard. But it's there. It's the plain language is what Judge Wood has emphasized. But isn't it 403 that the district judge has to use to decide finally, does the door open to this evidence?
I think that's right.
Right. And we just want some little greater analysis. Is that what we're looking for? What would the government suggest should be incorporated in the actual words? As Judge Candy said magic words earlier. What should the district judge intone in specificity and reference to 403 that would satisfy courts of appeals?
Right. I think the district court should explain how the evidence is relevant to a fact of consequence, how that relevance does not depend on a character inference.
All right. Now, does he do that or she do that at the time of ruling outside the presence of the jury initially?
Yes.
So what we want then is a headnote version of that dialogue in some fashion to the jury either at that point in time or again at the end for final instructions?
Well, on the question of admissibility, I think the evidence is going to be discussed and ruled on outside the presence of the jury. The judge should make these findings.
Perhaps even before trial.
Perhaps even before trial, often before trial.
Right.
The judge and the defendant will want to know, I'm sorry, the government or the plaintiff.
Let's say a judge goes through the analysis prior to trial, and he or she finds no difference after hearing evidence during the course of the trial. Would it be your position or recommendation that there be, again, an intoning of the specificity that he or she, the trial judge, made pre-trial?
For the purpose of the jury instruction? Or for
yes.
I'm not sure the jury instruction would be a matter of intoning, but it would be an encapsulation of the judge's thinking about or finding about how the evidence is relevant without relying on character or propensity.
Well, would that distillation and that instruction mid-trial have to be modified at the conclusion with if additional factors came into play in the trial?
It could,
So we're talking about perhaps multiple types of instructions here, or multiple layers of instruction dealing with this issue.
Perhaps, and the reason I say that is because sometimes issues, matters that are in dispute can vary over the course of a trial.
Exactly.
They can be fluid, and what is in dispute at the outset of the trial may not necessarily be in dispute at the end of the trial or the end of the government's case. So depending on how the trial plays out and how the case is argued or cross-examined or what takes place in the opening statement or even the defendant's case, you may end up with a different permissible purpose for the evidence or what was previously a permissible purpose, what was previously in dispute and no longer is in dispute. So it wouldn't make sense to continue to instruct the jury on something for which the evidence its probative value is outweighed by the risk.
What would you think of this instruction? At the end of the case, I don't think it should be in the middle because it draws attention to the evidence. Why couldn't you just say at the end, look, among the bits of evidence you heard the government argue that the fact that Gomez had this cocaine in his house made it more likely that he was the same person on the phone. And you can consider that argument, but that's the only relevance of that cocaine. It doesn't have anything else to do with the case except, you know, who was on the phone, right? Now, would that do it, or do you have to have something more elaborate?
Well, I think it may be helpful, and
my question is this an adequate instruction, or do you need more?
I'm not sure you need more. Maybe
you want more.
Maybe good to have more.
What
to spell
would
out,
be good to have more?
Well, you may consider it only for the question of whether he's the man on the phone. You may not consider it for deciding he's got a bad character.
I think that's helpful to you. I don't think the defendants want.
How can bad prior bad acts not go to character?
Well, not all 404B evidence is bad acts, of course.
No, of course.
But
we're talking about bad acts here.
We are. Bad acts, I think, and this is the delicate balancing the court has to do under Rule 403. Is that there's,
that's what I meant by 403 having to do the
right.
lift. And by the jurist who's absorbing the particular facts and case before him.
Right. Well,
but why can't you, I mean, if you're going to add something, maybe you just didn't phrase it right, because the rest of 404B1 says you can't use it in order to show that they acted in accordance with whatever they had done before. So in plain English, you can't draw the inference, we did it before, did it again. I mean, there's got to be a plain English way to communicate that and tell them you can't do that.
I'm sure there is a plain English way to do that.
We'll work on it.
isn't able to come up with it standing here.
Isn't the problem here, Mr. Fullerton, though, to get to Judge Flom's question? I mean, if I understood what he was saying correctly, that when we're talking about prior bad acts not charged in the case, we're really playing with fire. Now, fire can be useful. It can be highly probative in some cases to show identity, to show motive, to show modus operandi, for example. And that's powerful evidence that needs to be available to the government. But it also carries with it this very, very high risk of misuse. And so what we're trying to do is just figure out the best way to keep the fire under control, basically.
There's no question that prior bad act evidence can carry risk of unfair prejudice. I think a point we make in the brief, though, is that just because prior act evidence carries with it the risk that some jurors may take from it a propensity or character inference, doesn't automatically make it excludable.
Right.
It may have with it a proper, more logical inference available to the jury from the evidence that shouldn't make it inadmissible in the first instance. And that's a matter of instruction. That's a matter of the judge weighing
in. Why don't you tell the jury, look, the fact that he had cocaine, the fact cocaine was found later in his apartment, that doesn't mean he's a dealer. Doesn't mean he's a dealer.
Well, as I said, it's difficult for me to come up with an instruction on the fly standing
here.
See, that's what you don't want to say, because that's what you wanted them to think.
Right.
Exactly.
I guess what I'm suggesting...
Well, what's wrong with that? Just say the fact that he has had cocaine, which the government says is relevant to whether he's the person on the phone, that doesn't mean that he's a dealer.
Well, they could...
That sort of guts your case, doesn't it?
It's a proof of a negative, which is ridiculous.
I wouldn't...
What's your hesitation? I don't understand.
I'm just concerned there may be other character or propensity inferences that are not excluded by Your Honor's language there. And we may want to have an instruction that takes care of more than that. I don't think it would gut the government's case.
That's not what you're interested in.
I don't think such an instruction would gut the government's case. We weren't relying on Gomez's possession on the 29th to prove that he was guilty of the crime charge.
Why are you fighting so hard for it? I don't even know if you had all this other evidence, all these other tapes, and his admission that he's the person on three of them, et cetera, et cetera. Seems to me you wanted this just to show that because he had cocaine in his room on the 29th, he must have been the guy on the phone, he must have been the dealer.
I don't agree, Your Honor. I think it was no more than what I described earlier, that it's an element of the description of the man on the phone. And as we often see with these cases, it's sometimes clearer in hindsight how the evidence works at trial than it is at the time. And
we specialize in hindsight here.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Fullerton.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Rentz, and please recall that one of your tasks is the standing question from Judge Wood.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. The government's proposed 404B test is not useful in screening for propensity inferences, and the major problem with their test lies in the first prong. The first prong is, as Your Honor pointed out, merely a relevance analysis. It asks if the evidence is relevant to, and then quotes the rule for relevance and does nothing more. The problem with this is that 404B analysis requires a higher bar than mere relevance.
But I don't understand why. We've got a series of rules. It has to be relevant. That's 401 and 402. The next question is it character or propensity evidence? If so, it drops out. If it's relevant and not character or propensity evidence, we're done with 401, 402, and 404. And then we've got 403. Now, I certainly can understand an argument that all of the character propensity evidence has got dynamite in it, and therefore under Rule 403, it's more likely to be unduly prejudicial. But I don't see how there's any special gate in Rule 404 other than figuring out whether it violates 404B1.
Well, the problem is that it only addresses 404B1. It says the
evidence. No, the district judge has got to do all three. First, he's got to figure out if it's relevant. Whether it's barred by 404B depends on the theory of relevance. And then that's also going to guide the decision under Rule 403. But every time you start talking about, you know, prongs of tests, all I can think about is a pitchfork. And what we really need to think about is what the language of the rules tells us we should be doing.
So let me expand on that just a little bit. We all agree that, I think even you agree, that one of the things the district judge has to do is figure out what's excluded by that language in 404B1 that says you can't use it to show that on a particular occasion the person did this. So in my opinion, the real question is at what level of detail does the district judge need to do that, and how much work does the district judge have to do spelling out that chain of inferences, and then further, how much do you tell the jury about that without actually intruding in the role of the jury and giving them some long dissertation about how the evidence fits into the case? That's normally the jury's view once you've decided it comes in.
Your Honor, what should happen is that the proponent of the evidence should be able to identify the purpose they're using the evidence for and then state to the district court how the evidence should be used in the mind of the jury to prove that specific purpose.
So apply that to what happened here. The government repeatedly, they've given up the other 2 points, but the government repeatedly has said the purpose is identity. It's right there in the list of 404B2. And they have said, we think identity is proven by the fact that there was cocaine in the room of the man who had one of the telephones that was used.
Yes, Your Honor. So in Gomez's case, the government did identify identity as a purpose, and they would meet the first prong of our new test. However, when you get to prong two, which asks how that evidence is used without relying on propensity, the government made no argument and the district court made no record of how that evidence was proper without relying on propensity. And that is where the evidence fails. A 403 analysis would need not even be done because there isn't a link or there isn't a chain that gets the evidence into being admitted without relying on propensity. It is also important to note that in Gomez's case, no 403 analysis was done, as the district court judge did not mention the word prejudice one time. But if you apply the test that the court order has proposed, it will create a clear record for each of the possible identified uses of the evidence.
But if Gomez had had no cocaine, wouldn't you use that as evidence?
If Gomez did not have cocaine? Your Honor, what was done at trial was that the defense...
You're not answering my question. It's a very simple question.
Yes, we did use the fact that there was no evidence that Gomez was in possession of cocaine.
No, what I'm saying is if there was no evidence in his house, in the apartment he lived in, would you use that as evidence?
At the time he was arrested, I do not think that is necessary evidence in this case, because the pure fact...
You're not following me. If there was no cocaine in his house, apartment, whatever it was, would you use that as evidence of his innocence?
Yes, Your Honor, that would be relevant evidence. However, under Rule 404B, evidence need be more than relevant. Because of the propensity inferences associated with this cocaine, if it was cocaine, the evidence should not have been admitted. And this goes to a Rule 403 analysis as well. Rule 403 says that the evidence should not be admitted if unduly prejudicial. But there are also other elements of Rule 403, such as
While you're finding it, I'm going to note that 404A2 capital A creates an exception to this other act's rule, saying a defendant may offer evidence of the defendant's pertinent trait, and if it's submitted, the prosecutor can rebut. So actually, the situation where there's no cocaine found in the bedroom is covered there, I think.
I would agree with Your Honor. And also, turning to Rule 403, there are other reasons why evidence shouldn't be admitted, including a cumulative presentation of the government. And this goes back to the disputed issue as well. If the issue is not in dispute, if there is no meaningful dispute on the issue, there is no need under Rule 403 for the government to present this evidence.
And what about the flip side of that, which I asked about and I will return you to? The government has, albeit quite briefly, said that this is much ado about nothing. There was plenty of evidence against Mr. Gomez in particular. And so even if we create the perfect 404B rule in this en banc hearing, the outcome of the case for Mr. Gomez should be the same.
We disagree because the error in this case was harmless. The fact
what,
that
was harmless? I think
I'm
it
sorry.
Was not.
It was a harmful error. The fact that the jury was given this evidence allowed them to decide Gomez's case on the propensity inferences as opposed to the relevant evidence put forth by the government.
So and you have to be arguing that the government's evidence was otherwise thin enough that this could have put it over the line.
Yes, Your Honor, because the evidence of the government that pointed to Gomez also pointed to Victor Reyes. And by admitting this cocaine evidence, it put one more tally on the side of Gomez that caused the jury to conclude that he was the conspirator based on propensity inferences.
Well, there were already other marks on Gomez's side. He admitted to being a participant in three of the calls. The phone bill is in his bedroom. The cell phone is found there that's in the wiretaps, and he disclosed the number of another phone that was in the wiretap. He surveilled near Romero. The Romero's car is traced there through GPS, or his phone's traced there, I guess, the alley behind there. It wasn't the only strike in Gomez's car.
But most of those strikes, Your Honor, also go to Victor Reyes. The phone bills also had Victor Reyes's name on them. Victor Reyes was included in photographs of surveillance and conversations with Romero.
Did Victor Reyes admit to his voice being on any of those tapes, any of the 61 calls?
No, Your Honor. But the fact is it was for the jury to decide if that evidence of Gomez admitting to it being his voice was credible.
Well, and that didn't admit to every call. We have to assume that to admit to three means to admit to 61, and that's where I'm not so sure we have a good record.
And he did not admit to every call. He only admitted to three. That's a fact for the jury to decide. And the jury improperly used the cocaine evidence to decide.
Was the jury told how many doses, 14 grams,
to my knowledge, the jury was told that it was a half ounce, but I am not positive.
Doses.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I do not believe that the jury was told that.
So wasn't it clear from evidence that you're not challenging on propensity grounds that he was involved in some way with drugs?
It is clear that the jury could find that Gomez possessed that amount of cocaine.
Clear? Isn't the evidence overwhelming? It is associates and what Judge Tinder just explained. We know he was involved with drugs. The question, of course, whether he's a dealer, not whether he's just a druggie with druggie friends. But if so, if the other unchallenged evidence indicates he was involved in what's the prejudicial effect of his having 14 grams of cocaine in his apartment? Unless the jury is told, oh, look, this could be 100 doses. That's, you know, only a dealer would have 100 doses. He's not even told about dosage.
Well, Your Honor, I'll answer your question in two points. One, the government could have said how many doses that amount of cocaine
they didn't,
was.
You say. And so the jury isn't told this is must be a dealer quantity because
it's
so many.
Yeah, and in fact, they were actually told the contrary. Weren't they told that it could have been a dealer quantity, but they weren't sure it could have
been
a user
quantity? That's exactly what they were told. There was no...
Well, isn't that pretty harmless?
No, Your Honor, because it still puts cocaine in Nicholas Gomez's hand.
Yeah, but we know he's involved with cocaine from the evidence you don't challenge.
The jury could conclude that he was involved with cocaine.
How could it conclude that he wasn't?
You'd be deaf, dumb, and blind not to conclude that.
Your Honor, being involved with someone, or I'm sorry, not involved, but being in the mere presence of someone.
Understand. But the point is, he was involved in cocaine and the evidence clearly showed it. Not what the end result was. It doesn't mean he's guilty of the crime with which he is charged, but it sure means that he has something to do with cocaine.
But the evidence is prejudicial because it puts cocaine in his hands when no other evidence did so. The other evidence may have put him in the near vicinity of activity associated with cocaine, but it never put the cocaine in Mr. Gomez's hands. And by putting the cocaine in the hands of Gomez, that evidence was prejudicial, and there was an error in admitting this evidence.
Thank you, Ms. Rentz. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.